Winston S. Churchill, The Second World War, Volume 5, Closing the Ring. ...1943 and early 1944 were busy years for my grandfather, and the strain of war took its toll. He suffered a severe bout of pneumonia while in Tunis, but thankfully made a full recovery. That was important, for he needed all his wisdom and courage for the momentous decisions that had to be made during this period about Allied strategy for the prosecution of the war to final victory. Major war councils were held in Washington, Quebec, North Africa, Cairo, and Tehran. The latter was the first at which all three great wartime leaders, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, met together in conference. The discussions at most of these meetings centered on two main issues: the cross-channel invasion set for 1944, and how best to use Anglo-American forces in the meantime to strike at the Axis and relieve the pressure on the Soviets. And relief they still needed, with 185 German and other enemy divisions ranged against them on the Eastern Front. A less important matter, but nevertheless one that grew in importance over time, was the question of the character of the post-war world, how to deal with Germany, how to enforce the peace and create a new international system. After the defeat of the Africa Corps, there was a vigorous debate between the British and Americans about the next stage of the campaign in the Mediterranean. My grandfather favored an invasion of mainland Italy and the use of small forces in the Aegean to regain control there, which would help Allied ambitions in Greece, Yugoslavia, and Turkey, and would open a new supply route to the Soviets through the Dardanelles. At no time did my grandfather wish to undermine Overlord, the code name for the cross-channel invasion, and he explains this at several points in his narrative. The Americans were more cautious and worried by the constraints imposed upon Allied operations by the shortage of landing craft for amphibious operations. In the end, my grandfather got most of what he wanted, though too late to reap all the advantages that might have come with more adventurous and speedy decisions. Italy was invaded, and great advances were made until operations bogged down late in 1943. In Yugoslavia, Tito's partisans became ever more active, and together with the campaign in Italy, tied down many German divisions that might otherwise have been used in Normandy or on the Eastern Front.
The reasons which led me to hasten to Washington once the decision in Africa was certain were serious. What should we do with our victory? Were its fruits to be gathered only in a Tunisian tip? Or should we drive Italy out of the war and bring Turkey in on our side? These were fateful questions, which could only be answered by a personal conference with the president. A second only to these were the plans for action in the Indian theater. I was conscious of serious divergences beneath the surface, which, if not adjusted, would lead to grave difficulties and feeble action during the rest of the year. I was resolved to have a conference on the highest possible level. The doctors did not want me to fly at the great height required in a bomber, and it was therefore decided to go by sea. We left London on the night of May the 4th and went aboard the Queen Mary and the Clyde the following day. The conference, which I had christened Trident, was to last at least a fortnight and was intended to cover every aspect of the war. We had to think about all the theaters at once. Upon the operations in Europe, following the victory in Africa, we were in complete agreement. It had been decided at Casablanca to attack Sicily, and all preparations were far advanced. The British chiefs of staff were convinced that an attack upon the mainland of Italy should follow, or even overlap, the capture of Sicily. They proposed the seizure of a bridgehead on the toe of Italy, to be followed by a further assault on the heel, as prelude to an advance on Bari and Naples. A paper setting out these views and the arguments which led up to them was prepared on board ship and handed to the American chiefs of staff as a basis for discussion on our arrival in Washington. We anticipated more difficulties in reaching agreement with our American friends over the second great sphere of British military action, namely the operations from India. Many plans had been set forth on paper, but we had little to show in fact. The President and his circle still cherished exaggerated ideas of the military power which China could exert, if given sufficient arms and equipment. They also feared unduly the imminence of a Chinese collapse if support were not forthcoming. I disliked thoroughly the idea of reconquering Burma by an advance along the miserable communications to Assam. I hated jungles, which go to the winner anyway, and thought in terms of air power, sea power, amphibious operations, and key points. It was, however, an essential to all our great business that our friends should not feel we had been slack in pulling our weight, and be convinced that we were ready to make the utmost exertions to meet their wishes. What happened in Burma will be recounted later. On May the 11th, we arrived off Staten Island. Harry Hopkins was there to meet us, and we immediately entrained for Washington. The President was on the platform to greet me, and whisked me off to my old rooms at the White House. The next afternoon, May the 12th, at 2:30 p.m., we all met in his oval study to survey and lay out our work at the conference. Mr. Roosevelt asked me to open the discussion. According to the record, the essence of my thought was as follows. We should never forget that there were 185 German divisions on the Russian front. We had destroyed the German army in Africa, but soon we should not be in contact with them anywhere. The Russian effort was prodigious and placed us in their debt. The best way of taking the weight off the Russian front in 1943 would be to get or knock Italy out of the war, thus forcing the Germans to send a large number of troops to hold down the Balkans. We had a large army and the Metropolitan Fighter Air Force in Great Britain. We had our finest and most experienced troops in the Mediterranean. The British alone had 13 divisions in northwest Africa. Supposing that Sicily was completed by the end of August, what should these troops do between that time and the date in 1944, 7 or 8 months later, when the cross-channel operation might first be mounted? They could not possibly stand idle, and so long a period of apparent inaction would have a serious effect on Russia, who was bearing such a disproportionate weight. Mr. Roosevelt agreed that to relieve Russia, we must engage the Germans. But he questioned the occupation of Italy, which would release German troops to fight elsewhere. He thought that the best way of forcing Germany to fight would be to launch an operation across the Channel. I replied that as we were now agreed, we could not do this till 1944. It seemed imperative to use our great armies to attack Italy. I did not think that an occupation of the whole peninsula would be necessary. If Italy collapsed, the United Nations would occupy the ports and airfields needed for further operations into the Balkans and southern Europe. An Italian government could control the country, subject to Allied supervision. All these grave issues were now to be thrashed out by our combined staffs and their experts. The discussions continued, much helped by the skill and tact of Harry Hopkins. But I was disturbed that no definite decision had been taken regarding the invasion of Italy after the conquest of Sicily. In the end, it was agreed that General Marshall should accompany me to Algiers to discuss matters further with General Eisenhower. The circumstances of our meeting were favorable to the British. We had 3 times as many troops, 4 times as many warships, and almost as many aeroplanes available for actual operations as the Americans. We had, since Alamein, not to speak of the earlier years, lost in the Mediterranean 8 times as many men and 3 times as many ships as our allies. But what ensured for these potent facts the fairest and most attentive consideration with the American leaders was that, notwithstanding our immense preponderance of strength, we had continued to accept General Eisenhower's supreme command and to preserve for the whole campaign the character of a United States operation. The American chiefs do not like to be outdone in generosity. No people respond more spontaneously to fair play. If you treat Americans well, they always want to treat you better. Nevertheless, I consider that the argument which convinced the Americans was on its merits overwhelming. The meeting with Eisenhower went well. The proposal that gained general support involved 2 possible courses of action. The first, favored from the beginning by the Americans, was an invasion of Sardinia and Corsica. The second was the invasion of mainland Italy. The final decision between these two options would be made once the course of events in the Sicilian campaign was clear. We met again on the afternoon of May the 31st. Mr. Eden arrived in time to be present. I tried to clinch matters and said my heart lay in an invasion of southern Italy, but the fortunes of battle might necessitate a different course. At any rate, the alternative between southern Italy and Sardinia involved the difference between a glorious campaign and a mere convenience. General Marshall was in no way hostile to these ideas, but did not wish for a clear-cut decision to be taken at this moment. He, General Eisenhower, and the combined chiefs of staff were fully aware of my feelings about invading Italy, but their only desire was to select the post-Sicily alternative, which would give the best results. An incident now occurred which, as it relates to matters which have become the subject of misunderstandings and controversy after the war, must be related. Mr. Eden, at my request, commented on the Turkish situation and said that knocking Italy out of the war would go a long way towards bringing the Turks in. They would become much more friendly when our troops had reached the Balkan area. Eden and I were in full agreement on war policy, but I feared that the turn of his phrase might mislead our American friends. The record states, "The Prime Minister intervened to observe emphatically that he was not advocating sending an army into the Balkans now or in the near future." Mr. Eden agreed that it would not be necessary to put an army into the Balkans, since the Turks would begin to show favorable reactions as soon as we were able to constitute an immediate threat to the Balkans. Before we separated, I asked General Alexander to give his view. He did so in an extremely impressive speech. Securing a bridgehead on the Italian mainland should be part of the plan. It would be impossible for us to win a great victory unless we could exploit it by moving ahead, preferably up into Italy. He was at once supported by Admiral Cunningham, who said that if all went well in Sicily, we should go directly across the straits. Eisenhower concluded the meeting by expressing appreciation of the journey which General Marshall and I had made to clarify for him what the combined chiefs of staff had done. He understood it was his responsibility to get information regarding the early phases of the invasion of Sicily and forward them to the combined chiefs of staff in time for them to decide on the plan which would follow without a break or a stop. He would send not only information, but also strong recommendations based upon the conditions of the moment. I felt that great advances had been made in our discussions and that everybody wanted to go for Italy. I therefore, in summing up at our last meeting on June the 3rd, stated the conclusions in a most moderate form and paid my tribute to General Eisenhower. Eden and I flew home together by Gibraltar. As my presence in North Africa had been fully reported, the Germans were exceptionally vigilant, and this led to a tragedy which much distressed me. The regular commercial aircraft was about to start from the Lisbon airfield when a thick-set man smoking a cigar walked up and was thought to be a passenger on it. The German agents therefore signaled that I was on board. Although these passenger planes had plied unmolested for many months between Portugal and England, a German warplane was instantly ordered out, and the defenseless aircraft was ruthlessly shot down. 13 passengers perished, and among them the well-known British actor Leslie Howard, whose grace and gifts are still preserved for us by the records of the many delightful films in which he took part. The brutality of the Germans was only matched by the stupidity of their agents. We, of course, made a wide loop out by night from Gibraltar into the ocean and arrived home without incident. It was a painful shock to me to learn what had happened to others in the inscrutable workings of fate. We have now reached the turning point of the Second World War. Henceforward, the danger was not destruction, but stalemate. To avoid that danger, American forces and supplies had to reach Britain safely, and that meant overcoming the menace of the U-boat. Anglo-American maritime power, a modern term expressing the combined strength of naval and air forces properly woven together, became supreme.